RadioInfluence.com.
Hello everyone, this is Saqib. Welcome to another episode of Tennis with an Accent, brought to you in partnership with RadioInfluence.com. And today we have Mark Woodford, who returns to the podcast for the third time. This is a good sign for the podcast when names like Mark, you know, keep coming back. Hey, Mark, how are you?
Saqib, I'm very well, thank you. Three times now, this is for me?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
That means we're doing something right here. I mean, it was a rookie podcast. We had your blessing and some of the other players like Korda and Bjorkman. And now I think you guys are, you know, too kind to keep coming back on my invite. But I enjoy this all the time.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation and, you know, maybe to be able to provide, you know, some different insight. I think a lot of current players and obviously past players, you know, that are close to the game, we have, you know, some opinions and they're not all the same opinions. So I think that's, you know, great for you to be able to provide the platform to express different views for, you know, the fans out there that are following our great sport very closely.
Absolutely. I'm going to leave my bias out the door because we had when we met in Newport, I told you where I stand on the Davis Cup changes.
Yes.
But now since it's here, so I'm free to actually more than embrace it like any other fan of the game. But I'm a little skeptical how this is going to play out. But that's why you are here and you're closer to it. And we had Mark Pecci come earlier in the year, and he gave his side of the views. And some of the people, you know, like Todd Woodbridge, a lot of people are vocally against this Davis Cup launch. And I'll get to that part of the conversation because that's the main action for today's agenda. But let's talk about the recently concluded World Tour Finals. I know you were in London for a meeting, but this was the 10th year of the tournament in London. So let me start with a generic question. Are you in favor for this tournament to stay in cities that already have major tennis presence, or you think a little mix-up would be okay to bring it to non-tennis cities, something that Laver Cup is already doing? But what's your view on that?
I was there at the ATP Finals last year for the whole week, and that was the first time that I had visited the O2 Arena, and I was absolutely blown away by the environment. The setup at the arena is so brilliant, and it's extremely well attended. I think if you're watching it at home, you know, you can see the amount of people. I mean, there's barely a spare seat, and this is at the end of the year. It's at the end of the tennis season. They're trying to sell two sessions, you know, during the day and the evening, and obviously the attraction is all of the elite players, singles and doubles, are there participating. It's an incredible event, and the English or the British public do come out in droves to support it. And that's what the tennis players, I think we aspire to play in front of crowds. It helps with the emotion, you know, inspires you to perhaps play at an elevated level. And of course, you're playing for this crown of being, you know, the World Tour Finals, and potentially improve your ranking. So they have done an amazing job, the ATP Tour, with its current position there in London. I'm in two minds whether they move it around. You know, I think in past years, obviously it has. We've played in you know, different cities, Hanover. They also played in Asia. They had it one year in Australia. I think they've done an incredible job keeping it in London for the last 10 years. So I'm a little uncertain whether it would be wise to move the tournament around the world as many times as they have in the past. I think you also got to consider from the player side that the year is winding down in Europe, and for the players to actually jump on a plane almost at the last week of the year, after they finish playing in Paris-Bercy, probably to fly off to the Middle East or to Asia, I think would be have an impact that the ATP would be considering. I'm not privy to their conversations. I believe there is a lot of interest from many cities around the world to hold the ATP finals, and I think that's what the ATP board and the player council probably have to sort through. Is it worth perhaps diluting the event by moving it away from London, where it's been an amazing success?
Yeah, we'll wait and see, but definitely I'm also in two minds myself. Like I don't mind where the tournament is, but at the same time, it used to be New York when I was a fan. Back in India in Madison Square Garden, and then in the days of Boris Becker, Germany held it for 8 or 9 years, and then, like you said, it traveled. So it'll be nice, but again, logistically speaking, if the players are ending the season in Europe, it could add a whole different set of travel plans if it were to move out of Europe. But I believe the fall season was always in Europe, and when this was even held in New York, if I'm correct.
Yeah, I think so. I believe so. That was before my time when I was out on the tour. So, was like yourself, a big fan watching those finals played in Madison Square Garden. And I think it's probably easier to say in this current time that, you know, a flight of, 6 or 7 hours is not that much of an, doesn't have that much of an impact on today's players. I think they are much more accustomed to the travel. So even if it did, for example, if it did go back to New York, I don't think the effect would be that detrimental. But if it expands out to the Middle East or to other Asian regions, which are certainly interested in holding the ATP finals, it would be interesting. And I know Saqib as well, and I'll wave the doubles flag. The doubles players that are there in London this week are so over the moon. The fact that the ATP finals have gone back to combining the singles and doubles together. The doubles now is being elevated on the platform, equal to the singles, 8 finalists that are there. You've got the 8 doubles teams as well, and they're out there playing in the same arena as the singles guys, and the support for the doubles has been overwhelming, and that is something to consider. If there is also if the ATP are looking at moving it elsewhere out of London, that it must have the sustainability of accommodating the doubles year-end event as well.
No, very well said. I think that has to be taken into account, because I've spoken to some of the doubles players, and I was stumped actually by a question in one of the podcasts when Rajiv Ram's better half, Zainab, asked me the question, local players usually play doubles, so why aren't people, paying more attention to doubles in these tournaments? And as a result, a lot of doubles players are better off playing off, on the outer courts, because when they come to the stadium court before, say, a men's final or men's semi, the crowd's still settling in. So it works both ways, because, what has caused this? But, there are a lot of doubles players, and you are a legend of the game, and back in the day of McEnroe, a lot of top singles player, even Edberg and Rafter, played the competition, but now it's not the case. So when you're part of these meetings in various facets of the tennis governing bodies, I know this question was not planned, but now since you're the best person to answer this, what are some of the measures that are always at least considered so the doubles alignment is always done with singles, and it kind of moves forward with the main item that's a singles competition?
it's a good question, and I think you've almost answered it as well, put it into perspective for the listeners that, today's game, there aren't that many singles players that are competing in the doubles events, and certainly when we get to a year-end finals, I believe the only person, the only player, would be Jack Sock. So if you go back to 12 months ago, Jack Sock made the singles final of the ATP finals, the year-end finals. This year, he didn't qualify in the singles, but he's there winning the doubles tournament earlier today. That is something that is, in the past, you mentioned, some of the greats of the game that actually made the finals in the singles, and they could have been there in the doubles final as well. Certainly Edberg is one of those fellas' names. John McEnroe is another. For me, I know that when Todd and I, the Woodies, when we qualified for the year-end finals, that was going through the transition period where doubles was separated from the singles. It had its own finale. We played in Johannesburg. We played in Eindhoven, Holland. I believe 1 year it... trying to think where it was played in India, and that was the year, that was our last year. We didn't end up, even though we had qualified, I think, as year-end number one, we didn't end up playing the ATP finals, but it was not quite the same. And again, I go back to, as a player, I think you relish, if you're making the finale, the year-end event, whether you're there for singles or doubles, but for those doubles guys, they want to feel like they're part of a legitimate event. There is so much focus during the year on the singles players that that is an opportunity for the doubles to actually headline as well. And that is, I think, a consideration for the powers that be, you know, as far as scheduling. They have to consider, is there a player that is competing in the singles draw? At what time, you know, they'd probably have to play them earlier in the schedule, so that they can play doubles at the end of the day. And then, of course, if that player, that individual keeps winning, a headache is created because then, you know, there's less time, less turnaround time, recovery. So, you know, it's changed quite a bit because now we do have the individual doubles-only players. So, in a way, it frees up a bit of the schedule, but the players are still yearning to be out there on center court. There's not too many tournaments through the season that will put a doubles match, regardless of the quality of it. They just refuse to put it out there on center court because the TV, media, the coverage, that drives. They want to see the single stars out on the center court. So the doubles are generally relegated to the outer court. But the ATP finals, that's where they do an amazing job of getting the doubles out there onto center stage.
Absolutely. So let me ask you about Sock. A lot of people believe right now he's the best doubles player in the game. And, and not too long ago when Mac was playing and... I've heard this again. I haven't seen because I only seen the tail end of Mac's career on TV. So this was said famously about him that instead of practice, he would play doubles because, you know, he always wanted to play sets and scoring system, and it helped his game. But now tennis is more physical, more monotonous in terms of how it's played. So you think a guy like Sock, who's an excellent doubles player, can use some of this momentum from doubles to bring back his singles career on track? You think that's possible in this day of tennis?
Definitely, definitely. I think, you know, he's gone through a very tough 12 months that, you know, it was a huge end to his single season last year with spirited runs in Paris and followed up with the ATP finals. I mean, he's a quality player, and I say player. So for me, I still think of a player as someone who competes in singles and doubles. So for me, I give him a lot of praise. Because he's willing to get out there almost every week and play in both events. So, yes, I'm a huge believer that if you play in both events, your level, your standard is going to keep improving because there are facets of the doubles game that will help your singles and vice versa. So even though he's had a rough go of it in 2018 on the singles court, it's been a blessing for him that he's been able to partner up with Mike Bryan. I think that's some added security for him. They've had a lot of success, culminating with the win today at the ATP Finals. So, yes, I think that will help springboard his return onto the singles court. I think Jack Sock is too good of a player to be. I think his singles ranking now is outside of the top 100. I don't believe that he is a player of that ranking. I think he's more, you know, inside the top 50. I don't think he's necessarily a top 10 player, consistent, but I think he certainly is within, you know, the top 50, top 40 on the singles court week in, week out. And he's proven that he's one of the better doubles players. So I think he can hopefully derive a lot of confidence from the success that he's enjoyed in the second half of this year with Mike Bryan that will help, you know, getting back on track with the singles.
All right, so let's focus on Sasha Zverev, who was just victorious less than an hour ago over Novak Djokovic, who's, you know, turned the tables amazingly. You know, what, again, enough can't be said of his comeback, where he was in March and April. Now he's the undisputed best player of the world. But today he came in short against Zverev. Not sure how much you caught up that final, but what does this win mean for the young German, as he became the third player from Germany after Becker and Stieg to lift the year-end finale?
Yeah, it's a big step, isn't it? I think some of the criticism over the past year or year and a half is, you know, where is Zverev at the majors? He hasn't performed overly well at the Slams. He's been quite whiny about representing his country in Davis Cup. Yet he's posted some fantastic results at the 500 level tournaments, winning on multiple surfaces as well. So, you know, he is one of those guys that, you know, in years to come, you would expect him to be, you know, sitting at the top of the men's game. And I guess, you know, we tend to forget sometimes that he's still young. I think gone are the days where we have these phenoms that should be number one or number two in the world when they're in their late teens or early 20s. I think it's a little unfair to try and, you know, put that tag onto him that he should be winning a Grand Slam or at number one or number two in the world right now. I think his game probably has a broader base. I think there are a few more strings to his instrument, and I think it takes a bit more time for Sasha Zverev to actually master them. And obviously with Lendl guiding him now, I think that's you know, going to be a massive boost, as long as Sasha is listening to Ivan and not perhaps taking on board too much information from, you know, his dad. And I know his dad has a former player and has guided him to this stage, but I think it's time that the reins are held up, that passed over to Lendl. So this is a huge step forward for Zverev, and I'm just so pleased that, you know, it happens at this tournament. I think for him, to live up to that expectation in Germany after Becker, after Michael Stich, and of course you can't forget Steffi Graf either. Winning events like this and consistently playing for his country in Davis Cup, I think that status, that hero status in Germany, could go just, you know, reach the level of those other names that we've mentioned. So this hopefully has a big impact for Zverev in 2019.
So Zverev also spoke at this tournament actually about the length of the season, and some of the players, especially Yevgeny Kafelnikov, who you played against back in the earlier mid-90s, was also vocal on Twitter saying back in the day, the season was still maybe slightly longer by a couple of weeks, and we had best of five set finals, so we didn't complain. He said, the kid is great, I'm a big fan, but this is too much whining. But there's a school of thought that does believe the tennis is more physical, because I always argue Becker and Sampras came in slightly fresh, because back in the day there was somewhat more upsets or less consistency, you can say. But in the Federer, Nadal, Djokovic era, with the exception of Federer and Djokovic, a lot of top names do come in with some sort of fatigue when they have played the year in finals. So what's your stand there? I mean, what gives here? Is Sasha right, or is Yevgeny right, or it's a different era and tennis is different?
Yeah, that's a huge question. And I don't want anyone to think that I'm sitting on the fence with my answer, but I would actually say that they're all right. Kafelnikov is right in his analysis that back in his time, which is my time as well, they played best of five sets. The season might have been longer by an extra week or two. And certainly Kafelnikov was a player that consistently played singles and doubles every week. He played Davis Cup for his country at every opportunity. And then you have the flip side you said about Becker and Sampras, and the way that they played, certainly at the year end, given that they in the courts, the surfaces that they played on, which might have been a little quicker indoors, so the matches weren't as drawn out. They weren't as physical, and I'm sure there'll be some people that say, hey, you know, serve and volley is quite physical, and I do agree with that. But I think the way the game is now, yes, there are more baseliners. Zverev, I think the parts that I've read and that I've heard from him that I'm not really a fan. I'm a fan of Sasha Zverev, but the comments regarding his schedule, and I think he was rebuked by a number of players this week in London at the ATP Finals, that, you know, he is in control of his own schedule. If he feels like he is fatiguing at the latter end of the year, and there's not enough time for him to turn it around to begin the next year, then make an adjustment to your schedule. It's as simple as that. You know, so I take offense to hear Sasha Zverev use his platform at tournaments and to really bitch about the Davis Cup and the ITF and the lack of time off. He is in control, and his agent and you know, they can reduce his playing schedule so that he remains as fresh as can be through the year. It's not for the ATP to make adjustments for Sasha Zverev. He is in control of his own. He is the one that selects the events that he plays. And maybe he has to turn down some of the offers that he might be receiving as far as guarantees for certain tournaments, not be enticed by playing extra events if they're giving him a guarantee, with the big picture that he has to finish the year off and then prepare for the next season.
So, Mark, I mean, again, chicken or the egg, you know, that conversation will always be there. You know, when I talk to some of my friends off Twitter, offline, who are following tennis and they think the Federer, Djokovic, Nadal era, this is the golden era. And sometimes I bring in connections like different surfaces, how strings have changed, and quicker courts produce more upsets. There were more specialists. Sampras reached one semifinals. So there are a lot of you know, anomalies that you can point out. And now Federer, Djokovic, Nadal, Murray, even Wawrinka, these guys are super consistent. So you think, are the two related? Like you said, Kafelnikov is also right. And Sasha, maybe he's young, he's mouthing off right now. But at the same time, the season is physical. Like Akei Nishikori, he built up so much momentum. But then by the time he reached London, he was flat. So that's what I said. Not everyone is Federer or Djokovic, who sometime have paced themselves and they have usually peaked in these tournaments. Even the great Rafa Nadal, you know, he's been injured, or now, you know, he sometime hasn't played in the autumn season. So you think the longer rallies and the physical tennis has also caused what the likes of Sasha and Nishikori are feeling? Because things can be true at the same time, right?
I go back to my original response. I think they're all right. I do think the season is fractionally long. Look, the surfaces, I don't think there is enough variety in the surfaces throughout the year. They seem to be too much of the same pace, which lends itself to extended rallies. So it becomes a bit more of a physical confrontation between the players. They're playing the same way. So I don't see enough of a Becker or a Sampras or an Edberg or a Rafter out there playing right now. I think there's, you know, a lot of them. You could put a blanket over the bulk of the players that pretty much play the same way. Djokovic and a Federer and a Nadal, Wawrinka, Murray, they have that experience of playing big-time tennis, and they know how to pace themselves. But that's only a very few. I mean, you think of the bulk of the players behind them that are also trying to work out their schedule to learn what suits them best, which surface suits them best, and how they can best make adjustments to be prime for the big tournaments, the slams during the year. It's not an easy answer. But I do think with the proliferation of certain events, I know that you might want to head down in this direction at some stage in our conversation, but you know, the evolution of a Laver Cup and the evolution of the ATP Cup and possibly other events onto the calendar, I don't think they necessarily that they affect the environment of tennis. It's extra weeks that possibly make it much more physically demanding and mentally demanding for the players, and they're just kind of struggling with that.
Yeah, we'll definitely get there, because that was the agenda, like talk about the team competition and your views on the reformation of Davis Cup, and of course with ATP's own ATP Cup and Tony Gottsick, Roger Federer-led Laver Cup, those are rivals. Yeah. But a few more questions before we get to that conversation.
Sure.
So let's talk about man of the moment. Novak Djokovic came in short today, but what a season. And resetting expectations all over the game that he's again the standard of the game. How do you see his campaign for 2019? He lost his last match, but these are scary signs. His serve was more than accurate than ever this last few weeks. He's hitting the spots, maybe compensating for some of the speed, and he defends his ground game so well. He's the best mover. He can turn offense right from some of the most awkward positions in court. So what does the rest of the field do to catch up? I know Zverev won today, but how many people can measure up to Djokovic in full flight in best of five?
Yeah, it was an amazing year for, or second half of the year for Novak Djokovic. A bit of a surprise how quickly, it ended with two slams and numerous victories over, his opponents, quality opponents, and certainly gives the impression that he will dominate in 2019. I think he's just very comfortable bringing back Marin Vider as his coach. They're working on things that obviously they were previously. He feels confident. He trusts the information from Marin Vider. It's going to be a huge, huge year and hugely interesting to see whether there is someone out there, whether it's Federer, Rafa, or Wawrinka, Murray, or someone like Zverev, who still at this stage is a little untested, underperformed at best of five sets at the Slam. So the question is, can one of those or a couple of those reach the level that Djokovic has put out there over the last 6 months?
Interesting. And then there's another news that was floating around in the tennis world was Julian Benneteau, who recently retired from professional tennis, I believe, gave an interview to a French radio station, and Roger Federer's name was doing, a lot of attention out of that, as he made certain connections with the Laver Cup. Having a conflict of interest with Craig Tiley, and even USTA are part of some sort of investment group in Laver Cup. And then Federer did play 12 of the 14 matches. I'm sure you've read all about it. It's kind of old news now. We even had a full podcast dedicated to it. But since I have you here, what's your take on the whole episode, and how close are you to it?
I think it really overlaps a few different areas. I commend Julian for making those comments, and I don't believe that Julian's not a malicious type of person that is trying to take digs at any individuals. I think they're just comments that perhaps, in general, people are unaware of what happens. The conflict of interest, for two people, one of which is the Tennis Australia tournament, the Australian Open tournament director and CEO of Tennis Australia, as well as an individual from the USTA, that are on the board that of Team 8 that run the Laver Cup. You know, I think he's, you know, Julian was just highlighting that, you know, the conflict that does, that possibly exists there, you know, because of the competing events. And, you know, as far as the scheduling, I look, if I was one of those top players, you know, in this era right now, and I know myself personally, having competed, you know, at that level as well, that if I saw that one a player was playing consistently at night, not having to go through the physically demanding conditions that can exist at any of the Grand Slams, you know, I'd be searching for, you know, a bit of equality. But I certainly do appreciate the responses that were put forward that will, you know, Roger Federer is once in a lifetime player. The generation today, you know, it is about Roger Federer, and the fans want to see him play in these prime times. I totally get that, but I just wonder whether privately Rafa, maybe Andy Murray, certainly Novak Djokovic, who at times does not really perform at his best in the real trying conditions that can exist in Australia, how they would possibly feel when they see Federer being played consistently at night. I would like to be a fly on the wall in some of those conversations, quite frankly.
Now, you were a player, so again, you know, a lot of things come out, and folks like us who are more representing the fan side, we don't really know the big picture. You know, of course, the conflict of interest can't be denied because, you know, Craig Tiley is part of teammate, like you said, in some capacity. So for all the fandoms and people who follow the sport, you think the tournament authorities should just, you know, put out some sort of clarity on what goes on with these decisions, or how do we take it? Because some say it's a business, some say there has to be some leverage of equality, and just enlighten us here, you know, because you are a player, and you, and even in your days, I'm sure with Rafter, Philippoussis, and a lot of Australians were getting favor, and then there were Sampras and Becker and Agassi. So what goes on in this kind of a situation when player A and player B both want to schedule or get the night slot? What is it that's not meeting the common eye, who's just watching this on TV or following this on internet?
Yeah, another example, Saqib, that I'll offer put forward is when Pete Sampras won his last US Open. That fortnight in New York were very trying conditions, and Pete hadn't won a major for a period of time. He certainly wasn't the favourite that particular year, and the conditions during the day, again, Sampras was, I mean, it's such a fine line, and people may say, oh, I mean, that's absurd to say that he wasn't fit, and I'm not saying at all that he wasn't fit, but in the hot, humid conditions, wasn't the best conditions for Pete Sampras to play in. He was more vulnerable in those conditions, and obviously being an American, I think he has certainly enough clout to request to not play in those conditions as you know too often. And I'm not saying for one second that the USTA would just have bowed down and said yes, whatever, Pete, or to his agent. But I think Sampras was able to play that particular year. A lot of his matches outside of the humid conditions that existed, that a lot of other players had to go through, and so he seemed to be much more fresh towards the end of the tournament than some of the opponents that he had to face at the latter end of that tournament. Of course that happens. In Australia, the Australian Open, we have our homegrown stars that the public want to see play on centre court along with the international stars. It happens at Roland Garros. You get to see many more French players playing on the Philippe Chatrier court as well as Suzong Longlong. and at Wimbledon. You know, you might get to see a few more British players on some of the show courts. So that's natural to see, you know, some players, but that's the international aspect. But in the end, it's the high profile players that will be able to have more opportunities to play on the center court, and the tournament directors of those events will, you know, they also take on board information from the TV, from the host broadcaster, from the international broadcasters that would like to see their player in an appropriate time zone in order to pick up the audience.
Let me throw a question which is closer to your end of your playing days. I remember when Australian Open was, of course, moved to Flinders Park in 1988 and then went on, and then the era of Rafter was fading into and the era of Leighton Hewitt was ushering on, and yes. Hewitt wanted like slower medium courts and Rafter wanted a quicker court. I don't know if the coverage was as vocal as it is today because of social media. I used to hear on ESPN that Pat Rafter would prefer courts sped up and Hewitt would prefer courts the way they are. So yes. What's the dilemma for a home slam when you have two superstars? What's your best bet? Both did not win. Both came close, but of course, Hewitt lost a final to Safin. So what does a home tournament do? I mean, do you have any recollections of those times? And how does this kind of a dilemma get solved if a home nation has two different styles of play?
Definitely back in that time, obviously Rafter's game was built around the traditional Australian way, very athletic, try to get to net, serve and volley, which was a type of game that I, aspired to as well. So I think during his time, he might have, asked for the balls to be a little livelier and the courts to be a little quicker, which would help, situations. But generally, they helped the Australians at that time. Leighton Hewitt's game was not necessarily built upon the serve and volley. He was more quite a different player in that respect, preferred the baseline, was able to stay out there all day, a slower court, heavier balls possibly. Yes, I'm sure, Leighton might have had some influence. Again, it's communication. I'm not saying that they would have, changed it simply based on Leighton's preference, but they would have, taken on board, feedback from Leighton and from some of the other players. And again, you'll see now a bunch of Australian players, they're not, they're more... I don't want to say baseliners, but they'll play predominantly around the baseline. So, maybe the courts might have sped up a little. And certainly from memory, I can remember the courts being on the faster side, low bouncing. They went through a period where they were slow and high bouncing. And I think they're heading more towards, a little quicker again down in Australia. As for the other slams, I'm not sure that I necessarily have their, aware of, their homegrown players. But I'm sure the national associations did would speak to their home players.
All right, Mark. So I think we have spent a lot of time on various topics, and these are all very important and relevant topics. But the whole idea for you to come on and on the podcast again was to speak on behalf of the changes, because a lot of fans like myself did not like the radical changes that happened, and now Davis Cup is going to be reduced to something else, best of three and whatnot. But you are a firm believer, even though you're a traditional Aussie, that this change was needed, otherwise the iconic competition would not have survived. So let's start from your angle. Why you think this is this was needed, and do you think this new change, with a lot of money being poured in from outside investment parties, is a sustainable model?
I am an advocate for the change to Davis Cup. And probably with all honesty, if I didn't see feel that Davis Cup needed to change, I would be totally supportive of retaining the model, best of five sets over 3 days and home and away. Unfortunately, I think I've been in a position now to witness and see what is happening behind the scenes. And unfortunately, the model that we've seen, for so many years now, the Davis Cup model is just simply not working. It's broken. I do believe that the competition needed to change, and when I've participated in meetings with the ITF, I've put forward for years this argument that Davis Cup needed to change. It needed to evolve, has been going on for many, many years. It's not just recent. It's been going on for 20, 30, 40 years. And it's only probably in the last 4 years that I think Dave Haggerty, as the president of the ITF and along with the rest of the board, have actually strived to make those changes to Davis Cup, to keep it alive, to keep it relevant. For me, Davis Cup, Saqib, is one of the great pillars of our sport, equal with a Grand Slam. And I haven't enjoyed watching players of today pick and choose when they play Davis Cup for a variety of reasons, whether it's schedule. Some will say that they don't want to be playing away in a foreign country on a different surface when they're jumping back onto clay. They don't want to be coming from grass back onto clay. Some put it purely down to financial, that they're not getting paid enough, that the riches, the wealth that is on the tour, that gives them, if they had to sacrifice playing on the tour for a few weeks to play Davis Cup, it's not financially viable for them. And I just think that's all, there are lots of areas that have colluded to Davis Cup not being held in high esteem by players. And I think if the changes hadn't been made, if the ITF hadn't stepped up, my opinion is that there would be no Davis Cup competition or Fed Cup competition alive within, a few years.
Okay. Again, a couple follow-up questions. I'll do first one. You said some of the big names were not, being fully committed to play the Davis Cup. But even going back to your era or the era before that, when let's take the example of Becker and Stieg. They did got together. They did get together for a Barcelona Olympics gold medal in doubles. But they played Davis Cup seldomly together. 1 year they played, they were beaten by the Dutch team, I remember, in 95, because Stieg led the Germans to a title in 93 when Becker did not play. So even back then, this whole thing with Federer, Wawrinka teaming up every now and then, I remember the stars weren't really committed even back then. So it was, to me, it was never about Rafa versus Roger or Roger versus Novak or Andy versus Rafa. It was always nation versus nation. So that argument, I don't know, was it really broken, behind the scenes? And then secondly, what happens to countries like India who don't have single stars? They will never join the big dance. So for those shores, Davis Cup will never come to India. That was the only chance to see a Mark Woodforde or a Wayne Ferreira or a Goran Ivanišević or a Pete Sampras. Now you are also taking away that chance from those audiences.
Fair comments. I think to respond to the latter question, Davis Cup still has the home and away format in place. The ITF understood that the desire for some countries to still move forward with playing home and away. So the first round, the qualifying round in February of 2019, will have 24. Nations, 12 ties that will participate in a home and away format still. So the ITF wanted to provide that opportunity for countries to have their stars play at home. There are a lot of countries, though, that do petition the ITF. That there's been a lot of been quite vocal that home and away is the heart and soul of Davis Cup. But I can only respond that there are many countries that petition to the ITF to sacrifice playing at home. They don't want to play at home because of the financial input that it involves to host a home Davis Cup tie. So they would rather play away because the host country is the one that takes care of all of the finances for the Davis Cup tie. So for me, the home and away is, it doesn't hold a lot of strength for some countries, not every country, but for some countries. So, you know, however, the ITF have still tried to implement for the qualifying round, the ability to play home and away. And don't forget, in the zonal groups, zone 1, 2, and 3, they'll still have that element of home and away as well. So it's not eradicated totally. It's just that the finals that will be played in November, week 47 from 2019, that's where it'll be played in one week in one city in Madrid, at least for the next couple of years.
Hmm. No, and of course I knew that. What I meant was some of the big names won't be touring. Some of the not so strong Davis Cup teams was because you know, if the tournament's in Madrid, the top teams would always be there. So again, using my home country as an example, so a Spain or a Serbia won't be coming to India. That's what I meant. But again, you answered that.
Yep.
So let's.
Yep. Which is, and I think you also said that the some of the top players in the past were very spotty elected when they elected to play, and that is true as well, and possibly it will happen, you know, in the future, even with this new format. I think there's more, you know, again, I'm from a time where playing for your country was about honour. I had no idea what I was getting paid, and I think I can speak for Todd, I can speak for Rafter, pretty much for Mark Philippoussis and Jason Stoltenberg. None of us knew what we were going to be paid. It was irrelevant. But the fact that we had the opportunity to wear the colours of our country, to operate as a team under the guidance of Neil Fraser, and then move to John Newcombe and Tony Roach, these were great times. So the financial side was irrelevant for us, but it was the honour. We were educated that we wanted to aspire. Part of a resume wasn't complete unless you had that ability to say that you played Davis Cup. But those times are different. That today, honour just doesn't exist. Financial.
I'm going to quote the great Aussie Don Bradman. A lot of the tennis audiences may not know, but a lot of the cricket audiences knows. I think he said a famous line to former Australian cricketer Greg Chappell, when sport became business, no matter what sport, I guess it's applicable now, it lost some of its integrity, some of its class, and some of its touch. So I think that's the world we live in. So
yes,
we cannot reinvent the wheel. So let's bring the conversation back to Sasha Zverev. Interestingly, you did say a few things about how he's kind of whiny about playing for his country. But, you know, the irony is, when I was in Miami this year in press capacity, I was in a small room with Sasha Zverev with a bunch of other reporters, and I asked him the Davis Cup question, the same question I asked you, and he was very pro-Davis Cup. He liked the idea that all the countries will get a chance to attend the final dance. Of course, the details weren't out yet and the exact format. So what do you think has changed now and then? Because Sasha was sounding so pro for this change, and now what you're saying, things have changed. I'm sure he's entitled to change like anyone else. So
yes,
just throw some light there.
Well, it's interesting that you say, in Miami, because I was there in Miami as well. I think you and I had a passing conversation at the time, but I actually did speak to Zverev during the Miami tournament. And so I'm pleased to hear that in a press conference at the time that Sasha was pro Davis Cup. I must say in the private conversation I'd prefer that to be kept private, but
absolutely,
he wasn't as didn't have the admiration for Davis Cup in the conversation. Put it that way, and he was more concerned about the length of the year being extended. But again, he's allowed his opinion. We welcome you know, the players' opinions. Definitely, we have to consider that. But I think what is lost with someone like Sasha is, and we spoke about this earlier, that a resume is not complete unless, you know, look, you can win, you know, tournaments, you can win slams, you can reach the number one. But I think for some of the tennis purists, they'll also look at, you know, have you played Davis Cup? And for Sasha Zverev, he could elevate himself into absolute superstardom if he was able to engineer and lead Germany to a Davis Cup title, much like Steffi Graf did in the Fed Cup, like Boris Becker did and Michael Stich did. I think you know there's something missing in his resume if he doesn't play Davis Cup, and if he's not successful with Davis Cup. The ITF has not changed any of the dates. I know that since Miami time, there's been various comments that he's made concerning his schedule, and the year's far too long. Well, yes, the year is too long, but you know, the Davis Cup has not changed dates. The final has not changed dates from where it's historically been placed. So, I think he was alluding to that somehow with the format change, that also the ITF have changed the schedule. And the truth is, the players of today have to play less weeks for Davis Cup now. It's gone from a minimum of 4 weeks to a minimum of 2 weeks, and it potentially could drop down to 1 week if a country makes the semi-finals of the Davis Cup the year before, because they have a free pass, like they're wild carded into the finals the following year. So I think for Sasha, it's kind of got upside down a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, to say that the schedule is so tough, and the ITF have, you know, oh my goodness, they've placed the Davis Cup into the last week of the year. Well, that's where it's been for so many years. And it's not, I don't think it's the Davis Cup that is exhausting him through the year. It's his schedule that he sets for himself. So the answer is, make adjustments to your schedule.
All right, so let me put a personal question out there now. You know, so you're a proud Aussie, and some of your mates like Woodbridge have been pretty vocal about these changes and how drastic these changes are, and nothing was broken. I'm sure you've had many conversations with them, in personal capacity. So how is this a sell to Australian public in Australia, which is such an iconic Davis Cup powerhouse country? So what does the Leighton Hewitts, the Nick Kyrgios, the Patrick Rafters, what is their acceptance to this format? Because Kyrgios had a very resignation look when I spoke to him in Miami, and he said, my views on Davis Cup are known. So now, since that ship has sailed, is Tennis Australia, especially, and Leighton Hewitt-led Davis Cup team, are they as excited about this competition starting next year? Because this is a new horizon and something they were really not too thrilled about to begin with.
You know, and I want to quickly throw in there, Saqib, I know that you referred to India as far as their chance at the Davis Cup, and I would, if I can, before I answer the question about Australian tennis there, I think this change of format provides much more opportunities for countries outside of the elite countries, and I consider the elite countries as the Grand Slam nations. I think it provides an opportunity for a country like India, with the new format being only three rubbers, two singles and one doubles. I think it enhances their chance of actually breaking through into the qualifying group and ultimately into the finals week in November of the Davis Cup. I don't think it is a detriment to them. I think it actually helps many countries believe that they can be there in the finals and play against nations like Australia, the USA, Croatia, and France. So I just want to throw that in if I can. And again, that's just my opinion. I think, you know, certainly for a team like India, I think as long as they can remain committed to the Davis Cup competition, I think the possibilities are certainly quite clear for them to be there in the finals week of the competition. As for Tennis Australia, yes, I know that they're it's been quite vocal against any format change, and I would say that we do Davis Cup very, very well in Australia. Whenever we play, it's in a major stadium, in a major city, and it's virtually a sellout for the 3 days of competition. The players are not just paid the prize money, so there is a prize money that is provided by the ITF for every country, no matter the level, whether you're in the zonal groups or the world group. But in Australia, because we are a wealthy tennis nation, the players get paid a lot more money. They're not just getting paid the prize money, they get paid extra to participate and represent their country. So the players are made to feel, quite exceptional, that it is of great value to play Davis Cup, and they're willing. The financial interest for them is quite exceptional. Now, there are a lot of other countries around the world that aren't wealthy, and I'll use David Goffin as an example here. He engineered, he spearheaded Belgium to 2 Davis Cup finals back-to-back years. He played every singles rubber in those 2 years. He virtually played, I think he played majority of the day of the doubles rubber. So you can imagine the amount of work, the physical workload that he put in to trying to get Belgium to win their Davis Cup title. He walked away with an amount that was no more than $50,000 for playing 4 times a year. But in Australia and other wealthy countries, they get paid way more than that. In France, the financial windfall for their players when they play at home, they receive extra money from the federation according to the attendance. So when they play in front of, last year in the semifinals, 20,000 people, the French players, they receive that money from the gate. When they play the final in front of 27,000, they get that the money from the attendance as well. So there is such a disparity between every country on what they pay players, and that's why you'll see someone like David Goffin, who once he learned of what the French players were being paid compared to what he was being paid, he elected to sit out along with the number 2 player this year when Belgium played the USA, and because he didn't feel like what is the value for him to play Davis Cup. When Great Britain, when they made the final a couple of years ago against Belgium, their nation lost £1 million. They won the Davis Cup, but their country lost £1 million because that's what they spent in order for them to, to win the title. So I don't see how a competition, how that is supposed to be working when, with these instances.
So you're saying federations with deeper pockets and deeper funds had a different route to Davis Cup compared to other federations?
Without a doubt, in this new format, that's going to be fixed? Can it be fixed, did you say?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Well, yes, I believe. I'm privy to the information that Davis Cup, they have sponsors that help promote the Davis Cup, but they were very skeptical of whether they remain involved with the Davis Cup, because they see other events that come onto the calendar that pay huge amounts of money to retain the services of some of the elite players, and they play in big stadiums, therefore, if they're involved in a competition that has no guarantee of the participation of the best players in the world, so they were in two minds whether they remain involved. Thankfully, the group Cosmos Group, they approached the ITF and said that they were willing to invest in the competition. They felt that it certainly they were aware that the competition was in trouble. And it needed to be revamped in order to be elevated back to its former glory. And, of course, that takes money. So, you know, when you've got nations that are writing to the ITF saying, what is the point of holding a home Davis Cup tie when we lose money? And if we lose money, that means we cannot put on a junior tournament. We may not be able to run a futures or a challenger tournament. Our grassroots program has to be suspended in order to run a home Davis Cup tie. Now, I just don't see, you know, how that is a system that is perfect. So the Cosmos stepping in and sinking the money into the competition, not only does it pay players, there's more financial reward for them to play Davis Cup, but the countries themselves, the national associations, are going to benefit greatly by the investment by Cosmos.
Right. So Mark, I know definitely I don't want to take advantage of your time here. Let me change the conversation to the competition Davis Cup is going to face, because ATP Cup is going to be launched very soon. And then there's already the Laver Cup, which has had two installments.
Yes.
And the only thing common among all the competition would be, you know, some of the top names. Of course, Laver Cup only uses 12 players, but ATP Cup and Davis Cup would use a lot of players and a lot of nations. So how do you see, those two events as competition, even though Laver Cup is a exhibition event, since it's not sanctioned event of ITF or ATP? But it's
for me, both events are exhibitions. The ATP Cup that was launched officially on Thursday in London, I think is a fantastic event. I have no problem personally with these new events. I think they're exciting, but the players are being paid. They're being rewarded financially well. The ATP Cup will offer ranking points as well, so that will get the players' attention. So the honour, what was with Davis Cup in the past, where there were a majority of nations that weren't paying their players that well to participate in Davis Cup, and there were no ranking points. Well, if you're being offered to play in some great cities where your workload is a whole lot less, and you might have the possibility of building up your official ranking, and at the sacrifice is playing Davis Cup for your country, wouldn't you take that opportunity? So I believe those events, just scheduling wise, I think it has an effect on Davis Cup. It has in the past, and it will affect Davis Cup. And I only hope, my ultimate hope is that with how it is right now, that the ATP, the Grand Slams, the WTA and the ITF sit together, and that's already happened. There was a meeting last Tuesday in London, but they work on collaborating together to make a much more sensible schedule that will allow the players to not have to choose between playing Laver Cup over Davis Cup or to play Davis Cup over the ATP Cup, if you follow me.
So does that mean Davis Cup finals, as it's going to happen for the last time in the current and the iconic format, You think that at some point would move up in the calendar, say close to the US Open, or what are some of the dates that are being mentioned?
Yes, that is certainly on the table. That is something that the ITF have considered already, was moving the dates. But I will also throw in, Saqib, I think there is misinformation. The ITF does not choose the weeks of Davis Cup. The weeks, the calendar is controlled by the ATP. And so they tell the ITF, these are the weeks you play Davis Cup in. So there was really no choice. So it limits the choice of when the Davis Cup finals can be played. You can either remain in week 47, which is outside of the calendar because that is after the ATP finals are finished, or you can move into September time, into week 37 or week 38. That would be much more preferable by the players, to be played earlier in the year after the conclusion of the Grand Slams. It's just, you know, finding the space for it to land, for the Davis Cup finals and the Fed Cup finals to be played at that time of the year. But it, again, as I said earlier, it needs collaboration between those stakeholders to make it work.
Mm. All right, Mark. So let's wrap up this conversation and get your views on the upcoming Davis Cup final between France and Croatia. If you were to break down this final in a very summarized way, who do you fancy coming out on top in this last format of the iconic tournament, which is going to be something different starting next year?
It certainly is a bit of a farewell to the old Davis Cup format. I think normally I would say France would have the edge in the singles. You know, when you've got Sommer and Lou Capuy as your two players, but they've really struggled this year. You know, Sommer's been out injured. We haven't seen him return to form that much when he has got back on the court. I think Luca Puy has really struggled. And I would actually put primarily that down to Davis Cup Blues. They won the Davis Cup competition last year, and Davis Cup takes so much out of you, you know, the energy that it takes. And I think they've suffered, Luca and Joe Wilfred, because they won the competition last year. So I give the edge in the singles to Croatia. Obviously, Cilic and Coric are hitting the ball, striking the ball well, winning matches. They're confident. As far as the doubles go in the rubber, I'd still give the edge to Herbert and Mahut. And given that they finished this year strongly, losing in the final today at the ATP final. So I think I would give them the edge over Mate Pavic and Ivan Dodig. But look, I think that the slight edge on paper goes to Croatia, but there is an edge that France will take into the tie because they're playing at home in Lille, where I think we can expect, you know, the crowds to certainly reach 27,000 again.
Mm. All right, so on that note, I think we covered quite a lot. Thanks, Mark, for doing this, and hopefully we can, invite you to the podcast sometime very soon.
It's always good talking to you, Saqib. I love the topics.
Thank you.
Hey, this is Bobby Sue Doyle-Hazard, host of Leveling the Playing Field, a podcast truly focused on women in the sports world. I'm so excited to bring this to you. It is for young women who are looking to get into the sports industry and women who are already in their careers, also looking to make a change. I want to put a spotlight on the amazing women that we have in sports now, and hopefully we can all learn a little something. Please make sure to subscribe to my podcast, Leveling the Playing Field, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and with my guys at RadioInfluence.com.